Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to exclusive episodes of This Is Actually Happening by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This Is Actually Happening features real experiences that often include traumatic events. Please consult the show notes for specific content warnings on each episode and for more information about support services.
They want to separate us from everyone else. They want us to never feel safe. They want us to never have a moment's rest. Just endless psychological terrorism, because that's how you break a person down. They want us to give up our lives.
From Wondery, I'm Whit Misseldine. You're listening to This Is Actually Happening. Episode 337. What if they delighted in your misery? Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. There's more to imagine when you listen. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. I'm listening again to the audio adventure title, The Count of Monte Cristo, by Alexandre Dumas, which ignites my wonder at the most daring and most vulnerable of characters, and sparks my imagination into another time and another world with this classic tale of revenge and redemption. You, too, can discover new genres to love. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. That's audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. Hey, This Is Actually Happening listeners. Have you heard that you can listen to your favorite gripping investigation podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreetruecrime. That's amazon.com/adfreetruecrime to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My father, as a younger man, he was quite adventurous. He spent 6 years as a professional rodeo rider, bulls and broncos. He toured all the way throughout the American Southwest for a number of years. Riding bulls professionally, even though the job only lasts 8 seconds or so at a time, it's a hard life to be able to do anything but be a weekend warrior. You know, to be an actual professional and make one's living at that for, you know, years at a stretch was quite challenging. When he started settling down, he became an over-the-road trucker for a number of years before he became a master electrician. My parents met at a horse auction. They were both very much into horses for different reasons. I mean, my father being a rodeo rider, but then my mother was a horse trainer for a number of summers. And eventually, she became a school psychologist. There's only one set of stoplights in the entire county that I grew up in. Westfield was a town of around 1,200 people. Our closest neighbor was literally a long-distance phone call back then. And we had drive your tractor to school day in high school. It was very rural life. I mean, we had horses growing up. I was surrounded by cornfield and cattle pastures. I mean, that remains true to this day. You know, life in Westfield was quiet and very cloistered. There was a lot I never had the opportunity to learn until I left. I just have the one sibling. It's my little brother, Kyle. He's a little under 4 years younger than I am. We were very close-knit. Both of my parents tried to encourage our better natures. My mother was an avid reader. One of the treats for us was going to the library every week, where she would pick up 7 books and plow through each one of them. So, growing up, I was the too-smart-for-his-own-good kid. I was very nerdy. I didn't fit in terribly well with my classmates. Didn't know how to relate to other children very well. I felt more at home with adults. Later on, we'd figure it out as ADHD as hell. I never got very good grades in grade school or high school because I never did the homework. Instead, I would just show up and bust the curve on every test I took. I really irritated the hell out of pretty much all of my teachers because they knew how smart I was. But I think I graduated with a 1.7 or 1.9 or something like that from high school, only to go to college and where I was able to pick challenging courses of things that I actually wanted to learn about and immediately made honor roll. Moving on to college from my very rural, very local high school was a wonderful growth experience. You had people from all walks of life, you had people from different countries there, and then also to be able to just completely reset. You know, here's a brand new group of people who have no preconceived notions about you, who haven't known every aspect of your life for the last 13 years, where you can just go in and be yourself and let the chips fall where they may. The school environment and experience changed radically, and I made friends very easily. I excelled in my classwork. It was going very, very well. 2 years into college, I was hit with a job offer from a close relative of my best friend, and the opportunity to move to Tampa, Florida, where we were both promised six-figure jobs after less than a year on the job. For a 22-year-old, that was a pretty attractive offer. So I took it up. I moved down there with my best friend and lived in Tampa for 6 years. I've always been a bit of a thrill seeker, a speed freak. I like very fast, powerful things. And being in Florida, there were fast cars and fast motorcycles everywhere. And it didn't take long before I was in a V8 five-speed Mustang, absolutely loving life. A girl that I had been dating for just a couple of months in Wisconsin, she followed me down. We got married 5 or so years into our relationship in 2006. In 2008, her father took ill. We thought we might be losing him. And so we made the pretty difficult decision to quit our jobs and move back to Wisconsin. We were trying to start a family at that point. So in 2008, I moved into Portage, Wisconsin, where I lived for 3 years. The married life and the trying to start a family life in Portage was nice. I didn't feel constrained as I thought I might, and we finally did get pregnant. A couple of weeks after that pregnancy was known, my wife let it be known that she was in love with a friend of mine who was going to divorce his wife and abandon the son that he'd just adopted a couple of months earlier so that he could move from Pennsylvania all the way to Wisconsin into my house with my pregnant wife and my dogs and my life. And would it be ever so convenient if I just went somewhere else and pretend I had never existed? I hadn't actually met him in person until that year for the first time. We had been two very prominent and frequent posters on a message board dedicated to science fiction modeling. It was called Resin Illuminati. I've been building models since I was 10 years old. You've probably seen the kits in Walmart, you know, whether it be cars or airplanes, and I just happen to focus most of my attentions on stuff you see in Star Wars or Star Trek or Babylon 5. I've got so good at the model building that eventually I stopped doing kits. Just get plain sheets of flat plastic and then create models from scratch. For a while there, I was making what are known as masters, which is where you would build the individual pieces of what would later become a kit to make copies, and then you'd sell the copies. Really nerdy, really niche stuff. But these nerds, this was cool stuff. My former friend was one of the moderators on the board, and we talked on that board almost every day for many years. We knew about each other's lives. We cared about each other. That year, we were at a model convention called Wonderfest in Louisville, and this was the first time I actually was able to meet this man in person, even though I knew all about him and had known him virtually for many years. That was also the first year that I brought my wife to that convention, so I could introduce her to all my friends. Some of them I'd known either in person or online for nearly 15 years at that point, and so they met at the same time that I physically met him. Unbeknownst to me, turns out while she was already pregnant, hit it off, and he decided that he was going to end his marriage, which had been on the rocks for some time. And within a couple of months, my entire life imploded because of this. So I went into a very, very bad place for many months. I had a divorce forced on me against my will, one that I did not ask for and did not understand and did not agree with, while I'm waiting for my daughter to be born. I went into counseling for suicidal ideation. I didn't sleep properly for at least, I think I lost count at about 70 days. I was just working out and drinking too much and just trying to continue existing. So I moved to Milwaukee. Moved in with a couple of friends of mine before I kind of got my head back on straight and then went out and got my own apartment for the first time. I started doing stand-up in 2012, just on a lark. Found it very useful therapy for everything else that had been happening in my life up to that point. You know, just getting through the pain of going through a divorce and trying to sort out what rebuilding a life meant. During this time, I started to go out on dates. I think it was my third first date where I met a very, very bright, very ambitious, very well-read, a very funny, beautiful young lady. At the very beginning, I was still going through the divorce proceedings, and she was coming out of a relationship as well, where a similar situation, the gentleman in question had not been faithful. We somehow got through that, continued wanting to see each other, despite the fact we were both emotionally broken handfuls. And when we both kind of finished putting our heads back together and came up for oxygen, we realized we were both still there. And we're still there for each other. And then it wasn't long after that that we ended up moving in together in this house that we live in now. We got married in 2017. We're both writers. I'm an author. She runs a boutique agency that does SEO and web content writing. Life was wonderful. I got an agent. I got my first book deal. My first book was published in 2015. I've had 6 books come out since then. They're all varying degrees of sci-fi. Some are more geared towards murder mystery thrillers, some are straight comedy, and some are more military sci-fi. I've started writing screenplays. Her business has grown from just her to now where she has 3 full-time employees. Things were going wonderfully. In 2012, I started a Twitter account called @StealthyGeek. This was my first foray into what most people would call social media. And like most accounts, it wasn't very big. You know, I posted my thoughts. I'd get some followers here and there. Didn't break 1,000 until I'd been on there for a couple of years. But then in 2017, I had a thread go viral. It was an abortion thought experiment. Got like 60,000 likes, 6 million views, something like that. Actually got read aloud into the Argentinian Senate while they were debating whether or not to legalize abortion. I got interviewed for Slate Magazine for it. It went all over the place. But for a while there, I was adding like 1,000 followers an hour. You know, so all of a sudden I shot up to having 35,000 followers or something like that. It went crazy. I was able to use it to promote my books because at that point I had 3 of them out and then, you know, another one coming on down the pipe. And that was really nice. So that was my first real experience with like being the main character on Twitter for a day or two. So that kind of changed the way I looked at social media, the way I interacted with it, and what I used it for, and what I thought it was useful for. Because I hadn't really thought about using it as an activist tool before that. So I definitely leaned into it. I'd never been shy about my political opinions, but with the reach that that got, other opportunities presented themselves. I've written op-eds for the New York Times 3 times since then. I had a nice little thing going with The Hill. I've wrote a few dozen op-eds for them. It really broadened the kind of opportunities that were given to me and lent some weight to my voice. So it was 2018. I had tweeted out that I had never personally found the comedian Norm Macdonald funny, and that I thought my comedy friends were screwing with me. This had come at a time that he was getting in hot water because he had come out in defense of several of his colleagues and friends in the comedy community, including Roseanne Barr. Now, of course, right around there, Roseanne was getting in hot water and having her show canceled after she said some really racist things. Not exactly things that you should be defending people for, but that was what was happening. And so right around that time, Norm MacDonald suddenly found himself with a whole new fan base. Of course, these weren't fans of comedy. These were fans of cruelty. White supremacists. These were misogynists. And so they saw Norm getting canceled, quote unquote, and saw an opportunity to attack people who were criticizing him for standing up in defense of misogyny and racism. So my tweet, I didn't know it at the time, it got picked up by a hated community on subreddit, Opie and Anthony. For anybody out there who doesn't know, Opie and Anthony were a shock jock radio show based out of Buffalo, New York. They've been off the air for about 10 years now. But Opie and Anthony were notorious for a lot of things, but chief among them was that they weaponized their own fan base, to the point that they would call them pests. They would send their fans to go and disrupt public events. They would flood shows with calls, emails. They would harass them on social media. They would try to get their shows canceled. But then the show got broken up, partially because their own fan base turned on Anthony for things that he had said. But the trouble was, the fan base didn't go away, and now it had been trained deliberately to be this weaponized cyber-stalking force. But now they didn't have Opie and Anthony picking their targets for them anymore. So they started going out in free range, picking targets themselves. I was not the first person that they went after. They were, as I said, partially responsible for wrecking Anthony Cumia's life, and also his brother. They'd gone after them with every accusation you can imagine. But then they started going after other people. They went after the comedian Patton Oswalt, trying to start and spread rumors that he had murdered his first wife so that he could remarry. And then this Norm MacDonald tweet, that went out, and they found it. They saw somebody standing up to what Norm was trying to defend and decided that here's the next guy we're going to mess with. We're going to ruin his life.
Today's episode is brought to you by GoodRx. Are you prepared for this cold and flu season? Right now is the best time to get a flu vaccine, and GoodRx is here to help. Find discounts on the vaccine, and if you do get sick, save on cold and flu medications at a pharmacy near you. GoodRx is free and easy to use. Just search any prescription on the GoodRx website or app, get your coupon, and show it to the pharmacist. GoodRx is accepted at all the major pharmacies in your neighborhood. Every flu season is a good time to consider the vaccine, and it is for me as well. It's easy enough to find one at a reduced cost by using the GoodRx app. So let's all endeavor to keep ourselves and others healthy during these cold and rainy months. Remember, GoodRx works whether you have insurance or not. And even if you have insurance, GoodRx could beat your copay price. This flu season, stay prepared with GoodRx. Go to goodrx.com/happening. That's goodrx.com/happening. Today's episode is brought to you by Quince. As autumn attempts to fall in the Bay Area, I'm excited to ditch my t-shirts and flip-flops, and I'm dreaming of cozy sweaters and wearing layers. Upgrading to cashmere or adding a leather jacket is simple with Quince. The Italian suede trucker jacket is a cool weather essential, and adding it to my wardrobe won't break the bank. Quince offers affordable, high-quality essentials for any wardrobe, and the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices with premium fabrics and finishes. Upgrade your wardrobe with pieces made to last with Quince. Go to quince.com/happening for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happening to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happening.
First, we realized that anything was wrong was my account got suspended permanently for reasons that made absolutely no sense. We figured out what happened when one of my followers found them bragging about getting my account suspended on this Opening Anthony subreddit through a mass false reporting attack. So that started an 11-month-long process of me trying to get my Twitter account back, which I did eventually. But by that time, this group had already spent almost a year going after everywhere else I was online, going after my YouTube channel, going after my Instagram account, going after my Facebook account, pouring through 10, 12 years worth of Facebook posts, replies, pictures, reporting every single one of them. And all of a sudden, I'm getting my Facebook account locked for comment that was taken out of context from 8 years prior. It was insanity. During this time, while I was locked out of Twitter and was not in a position where I could respond to them in any way, they made impersonation account after impersonation account of me. One of these impersonation accounts had managed to reclaim something like 2,000 of my followers, and then used that to go around and start attempting to wreck my professional reputation by saying these awful racist, homophobic, transphobic, anti-Semitic things, sending DMs to people attacking female authors and agents, and often successfully tricking people into believing that I was actually saying all these terrible things. I had no way to defend myself. I couldn't go on there and say, no, that's not really me. They never stopped. They escalated. They just kept going further and further. They started doxing my phone number. They started doxing our home address. And at some point in there, they got a hold of my social security number through some data breach or another. We thought it was bad then. We had no idea what was coming. I'd been dealing with trolls online since the start. It's easy to recognize them, and it's easy to deal with trolls. You just say your piece, and then block them. Maybe they have a backup account, then block that account, and that's the end of it. That's what trolling behavior is. That's not what these people are. This is gang stalking. This is a cult. This is a literal cyber-stalking cult of dozens to hundreds. They would be hitting us from 100 different directions every single day. They had a countdown clock waiting for my next book to release so that they could coordinate fake reviews on Amazon so they would have 100 fake one-star reviews or more within minutes of it actually going live. They did the same thing on Goodreads. They made hundreds of Sock Puppet accounts so that they could leave literally thousands of fake one-star reviews to drive my ratings and my reviews down. And they would use those fake reviews to tell just absolutely outrageous lies about the contents of the books. But trying to get those reviews removed as illegitimate, as a defamatory attack, trying to get the tech companies to pay any attention to that was nearly impossible for quite a long time. This Opie and Anthony subreddit had, at the time, around 30,000 subscribers. They ended up spending so much time every single day doing nothing but stalking and harassing me, my wife, and our family, and our immediate friends circle, that the moderator of that subreddit told them, stop this. This guy isn't important. I don't know who this Pat guy is. No more about this guy. The things you're doing to him at this point are crossing into illegal territory, so I'm putting a kibosh on it. They turned on him. They doxed him. They put his home address and his phone number on the site. Like, they just tore him to pieces. The subreddit eventually got locked through something called the DMCA takedown requests, which we had to make hundreds of them because they would take images from the copyrighted covers of my books or my copyrighted author photo. They would take these and manipulate them and pretending to be me. And anytime they did this, like, we own the copyrights on all those images. So we would submit a DMCA takedown request to Reddit. And after a few hundred of these, the admins of Reddit as a site changed their harassment policies, specifically to purge the Opie and Anthony subreddit and all of its members from Reddit permanently. They not only shut down that subreddit, but they shut down something like 70 other subreddits. They banned thousands of their accounts and effectively killed them on Reddit, the site. From there, this cult started their own web forums, utterly and exclusively dedicated to criminally stalking my family. Again, these aren't trolls like anyone has had to deal with in their online dealings. This is an incredibly dark side of the internet. My wife and I call them an anti-community, because unlike the modeling communities that and forums I had participated in for a long time, where we were drawn together by a common love of a hobby, these people aren't there building a community. They don't trust each other. They don't actually particularly like each other. They just have come together out of a shared love of sadism and inflicting pain and harming people. The internet has unfortunately made that possible because, you know, pre-internet, like sociopaths, if they were identified, they would get ostracized from their communities. They'd be expelled. They'd become loners. Well, now all these loners who only get off by inflicting suffering for no reason other than it gives them pleasure, they're able to coalesce into large numbers and share the workload of fucking with one person or one family, which is what makes it so insidious, because it's not, you can't just block them and move on, because they're not going to move on. I'm not exaggerating when I say this is all these people do. This is all they think about. If you go to their web forums right now, you'll see over 1 million posts, all exclusively dedicated to obsessing over every detail, every utterance, every tweet, every photograph that I've ever posted. My life and their obsession with ending my life has completely subsumed their identities. It's the price of admission to their cult. This group is exclusively dedicated to ending my life. And again, I'm not exaggerating. They have publicly and proudly stated repeatedly that their end goal is to destroy my career, destroy my reputation, end my marriage, and drive me to suicide. Although, up until that point, none of this had been physical, the damage was still very real. The attacks on my reputation, the attacks on my books, the attacks on my career, the attacks on my friends and family and colleagues. Being relentlessly attacked every day from every corner, not knowing where it's going to come next. And just the amount of time that I had to spend pushing back against it, you know, refuting the defamatory claims. Similar things happened to businesses around here that the stalkers knew that we liked to frequent. If there was a place that we liked, we would post pictures of us with our friends, pictures of our lunch or our dinner, like so many people use social media to do. Until that was weaponized against us by our stalkers. They would go onto my Instagram, go onto my Facebook, find the places that I like, find the places that I frequent, and start bombarding them with fake one-star reviews, saying their food was terrible, or I found a roach in my soup. They would call in with fake orders. They would call in pretending to be the police, looking for Patrick Tomlinson because he's wanted on a warrant for child molestation or something. They would make these calls sometimes 30, 40, 50 times a day, just trying to drive the owners and the employees up the wall, trying to make it so that they would ask us not to come back. They've never actually stopped doing this, by the way. Over the entire course of this, they have texted harassment to me and my wife on our private phone numbers every single day, dozens of times a day for years. Insults, defamation, death threats. They use apps that temporarily assign them phone numbers. I've literally blocked 10,000 numbers at this point. It's complete insanity. So, up to this point, they hadn't done anything physical, but the damage to our social lives, to our support networks, was still real. I think it was late 2019 or early 2020, but things started to turn from just being online to active stalking. They started showing up to conventions that I was at and taking spy shots of me, like at a signing table or if I'm having a drink at the bar. They'd take pictures from across the room and then send them to me on my own phone while I'm sitting there, after they've made their exit, of course, just so they know that I know I'm being stalked and I'm not physically safe anywhere, ever. They have trespassed on our property. They've vandalized repeatedly our home, my car, my motorcycle. They've filmed themselves trespassing on our property. They have filmed our property and put it online, set to the song Somebody's Watching Me. The difference between online life and real life, I don't really think there is a difference. I think that distinction is meaningless and damaging because it allows people to see themselves as doing things online that aren't real. The people you're talking to online are real, and the things you're doing to them are real. So the things you're doing online are also real life. There's no way to separate the two. The perception that this online stalking and real life stalking are different things is false. There is no distinction, and the crossovers are so easy. I'm 44 now, so I am of the very earliest internet users. So there was experience on the internet pre-social media and post. Those old message boards were a way of really building community, and for the most part, they were self-policing communities. You know, if you had troublemakers, they were moderated out, they were banned, which is entirely different from what you get on social media, which aren't about building these little niche communities as chat rooms and message boards. It was very different. The way social media operates now, there are no guardrails, there is no privacy. The community building takes a back seat to the just aggressiveness and conflict that drives so much of the participation. Like everything else that these people do, they steal from you. And then they use that information that they've stolen to weave these convoluted tales about your life. They create this narrative of a person that they want to destroy. And then they force the evidence to fit that narrative. Any accolade or accomplishment that I have in my life, they find a way or invent a way that it wasn't true. They make up whatever justifications they want for the crimes that they commit. In their minds, they're the heroes of the story. They're the ones who are out fighting the good fight against censorship or liberals or cancel culture or whatever the new phrase of the week is. And they will lie to themselves just outrageously in order to accomplish that. The person that they hate, that version of me is not a real person. It does not exist in reality. It exists only in the delusions and the dogma of their cult. There's no justifications for what they do to me. And even if there were, there wouldn't be any justifications for what they do to my wife, my parents, my friends, my colleagues. And people often ask, it's like, well, why you? What's special about you? And the answer is nothing. You can find 1,000 people like me on Twitter with a fairly cursory search. They don't go after big people. They tried to go after Patton Oswalt. They tried to ruin his career by making up lies that he had murdered his first wife. Well, it didn't stick, because Patton already has millions of fans, and he has the financial resources to be able to address those kinds of things directly. If they started trying to attack him physically, as they've done to me and my family, well, he can hire bodyguards. You know, he has the resources. They're not going after the big fish. They're not going after politicians. They're not going after people who actually make a difference in the world for good or for ill, because they don't have the power. They have to go after the more vulnerable, the people like me who aren't millionaires, who can't hire 24/7 security, who can't have a bevy of lawyers going after them every minute. People with resources aren't nearly as attractive to people like this cult, because they can't do the damage. They can't inflict the harm. And the harm is the point. That's all they want to do. They want people to be scared, intimidated, hurt. They just want to know that they're making someone feel that way. The stress that having to push back against that every day for 5.5 years does to a person. I mean, you know, both my wife and I exhibit symptoms of CPTSD. Having energy to do everything else that you need to do in order to sustain your work, sustain your health, your other relationships, like, you've only got so much mental energy a day. And to have to devote even a significant fraction of it to these sociopaths instead of the people who actually matter to you in your life, it's draining. It is exhausting beyond description. We've only recently, over the last year or so, managed to positively identify even a couple of the people involved in this. Overall, probably no more than 10 people who are like the hardcore of this cult. The ones who are actually, they would say creating content, but we would say committing crimes. You know, stealing our identities in order to open fraudulent credit card accounts and try to take out fraudulent loans. We never know from which direction the next thing is coming from. It was during the COVID lockdown, so this was June 2020. They made a Craigslist ad pretending to be me, using my real name, using my phone number, using our real home address. And they made an ad claiming that we were giving away pepperoni to homeless people because of how hard the lockdowns have been. But the special ingredient in the pepperoni was African-American children that I had kidnapped and murdered and ground into sausage in my basement. They then used the fake ad that they made to call in a fake tip to the Milwaukee Police Department. It was a random Thursday night. We were several weeks into the COVID lockdowns at this point. My wife and I, it was about 11 o'clock at night, when all of a sudden two officers are banging on our door in the middle of the night, no warning, don't know why they're there. And I go to the door in my bathrobe. Their pistols aren't drawn, but they have their hands on the handles of their service pistols, and they start demanding to know where the children are. And I have no fucking idea what they're talking about. We get into a shouting match, both sides getting more and more irritated. Nikki finally comes out and, like, breaks us up and has to go and explain to them, look, we don't know what this is about, but we are being stalked. We are relentlessly being impersonated. We don't have dead children in our basement. So that was the first time. The second time, a couple of months after that, a bar that we frequent down the street had a fire. Within the hour, they were calling the MPD with a fake tip saying, hey, we saw a man that we know to be named Patrick Tomlinson running through an alley away from the fire, carrying a duffel bag. We think you should check this out. They were trying to blame us for arson, and the police were sent out for that again. In July of 2021, one of them threatened to start swatting us again. And so I called the Milwaukee PD. I talked to a dispatcher, and then I also talked to a desk sergeant. And I was like, the people who have already sent you guys out here on false calls twice, we just got another threat that they are going to swat us. They are trying, and they explicitly said they're trying to get us killed. So if you get any sort of calls of a hostage situation, of a shooting, dangerous situation at our address, it's fake, number one. And number two, criminals are trying to get you to murder us. The dispatcher said they didn't have any way to leave a note in the system and that there wasn't anything she could do, so she turned me over to a desk sergeant who also told me there really wasn't anything they could do. Not even 2 weeks later, my wife is up north attending her grandfather's funeral. The stalkers know that the funeral was that weekend. They left defacing comments on the online obituary of her grandfather, so they knew she wasn't going to be home. I wasn't able to go to the funeral because at that time we had a 20-year-old cat who had multiple things going wrong with her, and someone needed to be there to give her medication. So I was home alone taking care of our cat. At 1:30 in the morning, I am dead asleep upstairs. It's pitch black when I hear just an ungodly pounding on the front door. I don't know who's out there. I don't know what's going on. I throw on my bathrobe and I go downstairs to find myself faced with half a dozen Milwaukee police officers with their guns drawn, flashlights at me, shotguns, assault rifles pointed at my face, demanding that I come out, demanding to know where my wife is. The stalkers had made a phone call to Milwaukee PD, pretending to be me, and saying that I had just murdered my wife when I found her in bed with a man, and I killed the man too, and I have an AR-15. Come and get me, basically, was the gist of the call we came to find out later. And so the cops are there, expecting a shootout, expecting to find two bodies dead in the bed upstairs, and expecting me to be there ready to kill them. But at the same time, I'm furious because we had already warned them, and we were completely ignored, and the MPD showed up in force with guns drawn, including 12-gauge shotguns and their own AR-15s, waiting to draw blood if necessary. I was pulled out of my house. I was handcuffed on my front porch. During this scuffle, my robe flew open. So now I'm naked on my own front porch in front of all my neighbors. I am beyond furious. I am screaming at these officers, dressing them down. They force their way into our home. No warrant, no probable cause. Do an illegal search of our home. I remain cuffed for, 10, 15 minutes probably before they complete their search. They finally came back out and they took the cuffs off me, and then they were just going to leave as though nothing happened. There was no apology, nothing. No acknowledgement of the fact that they had been warned that this was going to happen and they showed up anyway. This was the first of 50 fake calls that our stalkers have made to just our house. These 50 incidents weren't like all over a short span of time. This took place over the course of more than a year. Every time this would happen, we would try to talk to a lieutenant and try to work out something so that they would stop coming out in force, so that they would have a note somewhere in their system that, you know, hey, this is a known swatting address. Half the time they would come out and everything, it would be fine, you know, they'd leave a card at the door. But then the other half of the time it would be violent, and we never knew which one we were going to get. Over the course of more than a year, there were multiple instances where the police showed up with a violent response, stacking up behind ballistic shields. They show up in force with assault rifles pointed at my wife's head. The next call, they send out two guys, and one of them tries to kick down our door because we don't want to talk to them, and we won't let them search our house. And that had been after this had happened dozens of times. Our lives, our safety, our continued existence on this earth was dependent on the luck of the draw as far as who was going to be there when the call came in. Sometimes it was as simple as, like, the normal dispatcher was out sick with the flu, and so they had some new person who was in there who didn't recognize the address. You know, was it going to be somebody who had already been out? Was it someone who was familiar with it? Or was it somebody who had just transferred to that district from a different district and knew nothing about us? There was no formal policy or procedure that was, as far as we can tell, was ever put in place. It was insane.
This Is Actually Happening is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This Is Actually Happening is sponsored by BetterHelp. I'd like to give a special thanks today to Ellie Westberg, who's been a dear friend of mine for many years, and now acts as the amazing and dedicated showrunner for This Is Actually Happening. This month is all about gratitude, and along with Ellie, there's another person we don't get to thank enough, ourselves. Therapy is helpful for learning coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself, and it isn't just for those who've experienced a major trauma. It can teach us how to find gratitude in everything, and in all our deepest relationships. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Let the gratitude flow with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happening today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/happening.
They have made half a dozen bomb threat calls, either in our names or directing the threats against us in 3 different states, 6 times. Our stalkers know that my wife and I attend the opening home game for the Brewers every year. 2 years ago, they made a bomb threat on opening day against the stadium. They're terrorizing our entire community. You can look it up online. It made the national news. There was a Patti LaBelle concert a couple of years ago in December here in Milwaukee at the Riverside Theater. Her concert had to be evacuated and all 2,000-some seats evacuated just a couple of songs into her set because there was a bomb threat called in. That bomb threat was our stalkers. That cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, $100 a ticket times 2,000 plus all the overtime of the police officers needed to shut down 6 city blocks in Milwaukee on a Saturday night. Not to mention the lost revenue for all the other businesses that they were closed down on one of the busiest nights of their week. They've done the same thing against conventions that I'm attending. There was a convention called PenguinCon a couple of years ago outside of Detroit that I was at that had a bomb threat called in saying they were going to detonate a bomb somewhere in the hotel as a distraction so that they could come in and assassinate me and kill everyone in my audience at a presentation that I was giving. On St. Patrick's Day weekend this year, they made mass shooting threats via email to multiple colleges and schools here in Milwaukee, in Waukesha, and in Madison, referencing either our names or our addresses or in some way tying them back to us. It's not just us that this is affecting. Swatting is not a prank. It's not a joke. People have died from swatting. They know what they're doing. They're trying to get us murdered. And so to have not only the stalkers be after us, but to have them be able to successfully weaponize the very people who are supposed to be protecting us, and now we have to be afraid of every interaction we have with the police, that it may turn violent, that we might get shot on accident. Our home, we're supposed to be able to feel secure here, comfortable here. We're supposed to be able to sleep soundly through the night here. They've taken that away from us. They've taken away our sanctuary. And again, that's the point. They want to separate us from everyone else. They want us to never feel safe. They want us to never have a moment's rest. Just endless psychological terrorism. Because that's how you break a person down. They want us to give up our lives. After nearly 6 years of this nightmare being lived out daily and hourly, we want to see justice. We want to see the people who have already been identified. We want to see them arrested for their crimes. The justice system has not just failed us, but has actively worked against our safety. That does kind of tend to color our perceptions of the efficacy and competence of law enforcement. This can happen to absolutely anyone who doesn't have a sufficient amount of money. Even though their obsession always circles back to us and to ruining our lives and to ruining our marriage, they do so by attacking everyone around us. And so, you know, basically anyone who is friendly with us or supportive at some point is going to get their turn in the barrel, where they're going to be attacked, where they're going to have their private information doxxed so that they can get harassing and threatening text messages and voicemails. Our network has necessarily shrunk, and it's not because anyone blames us. Just for their own safety, just for the security of their own family, some people have decided to bow out. They have to get out of the way. We've had important parts of our lives and important relationships just completely unjustly torn away from us. Because again, the point of this is to isolate a target, to cut them off, so that their harassment is the only thing left in their life. And they have not, on the whole, been successful, but they have had their little victories, if that's what you want to call them, where people have just given up on us for their own mental health and for their own physical safety. The hardest part of all of this has been just the relentlessness of it. That's the most damningly frustrating part of this whole thing, is the fact that they're just doing all this and smiling and laughing about all the pain and anguish and hurt that they cause from behind this veil of anonymity that protects them from what should be the very real and very immediate consequences of their crimes. And that's the hardest part for outside folks looking in to understand. The first question is that I'm always asked when explaining what we're going through is, well, what did you do to piss them off? They must know you from somewhere. You must have done something to them, because the level of obsession and depravity here is so psychotic, completely outside of not only a normal person's experience, but outside of their imagination. Something has to be so fundamentally broken inside of you to take joy and pleasure out of what these people do to us and our family and our friends and colleagues. We try very hard to keep in mind that these people are not representative of the rest of the world, that they are that 0.1% who are so incredibly broken, and that the only reason they're doing this and have coalesced around this is because of that shared brokenness in them. And that the internet has allowed that to happen in the first place. The failure of society as a whole to even recognize the existence of this problem, much less have solutions or protections for it, that's been the most disillusioning and disappointing part of this for us. We attempted to sue the owner of the website, that is, a website with 1 million posts dedicated to criminally stalking our family. We weren't actually trying to sue the owner. We were trying to sue individuals who had committed the crimes. It wasn't about the money. It was about identifying them so that we could turn those identities over to the police so that their crimes could be prosecuted. Because we'd been told repeatedly by Milwaukee Police Department that they couldn't do anything if we didn't have names of the people stalking us. from their perspective, stalking is usually a much more intimate crime. It's a relationship crime. It's an ex-lover. It's a disgruntled employee. It's someone you know. Usually you can say, yes, this is my stalker. They live at XXXX. Well, we can't do that. And because of Section 230, a court in California found that not only does their privacy overrule our physical safety, but that we owe them their lawyer fees for having the audacity to try and figure out who's attempting to murder us. Section 230 is really early internet law. It dates from the late 90s. It was a civil shield for online platforms against speech that was posted by their users. It was basically saying that the platforms themselves, just by hosting the content, were not publishers of the content, and therefore weren't responsible for it. The only people responsible were the people that actually posted it. Which sounds okay, I guess, if you're talking about like a normal platform like a Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, where it's a neutral site where millions of people are posting to it. It does not cover and should not cover a website that was created for the express purpose of continuing a criminal conspiracy against a single target's family. That's insanity. That is a misapplication of the law. But that's what was done to us. That's the other thing that's so frustrating about all of this, is that no matter how low they go, no matter what they do to us, no matter how many crimes they commit against us, we have to remain above board. Like, we have to do everything through legal channels. You know, we can't hire a white hat hacker to go and strip the database out of their website. That's an internet crime. That's illegal. We could be charged for that. And it would also destroy any potential we would have for any sort of criminal case that will come to fruition against them in the future. Because there are active FBI investigations into many of these crimes. So we can't interfere with any of that. We try very hard not to become suspicious of everyone, of every situation. We try to live our lives as normally as we can while taking reasonable precautions. But Nikki and I have been married now for almost 6 years, and for most of that, we've been dealing directly with this. And it's been us having to juggle our relationship, maintaining and expanding our careers, despite this weight being pressed down on us. It's disrupted our sleep. It's made us irritable. It's certainly led to arguments that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And it's taken away from our ability to relax and enjoy each other's company. They want to silence us, either through getting us killed, through getting us deplatformed, or through just any way that they can throw cold water on our story. And they do that through disinformation, they do that through lying, they do that through gaslighting, but they also do that by attacking journalists who will dare to speak about our story. The FBI has been aware of and involved and investigating this group and their crimes ever since the first bomb threat in Detroit a couple of years back. Because they're made aware of every bomb threat as, you know, potential domestic terrorism, and have to keep track of that. The FBI has finally set up a national swatting, tracking, and database to help coordinate with local law enforcement. The only way to counter it is to learn about it, to get educated, to recognize it, and then to advocate for solutions to it. And they, at this point, they have to be legislative solutions. They have to be new laws passed, and they have to be funded. And the only way to do that is to educate our lawmakers, educate our police. A lot of listeners may be sitting here wondering, okay, but like, how does this one poor guy's family's terror crisis translate to the larger world? But in a lot of ways, it's a microcosm. They employ disinformation. They lie constantly and flagrantly. They introduce their own narrative about past events and use disinformation tactics in order to further that narrative. You see this being applied on a much larger scale to society as a whole by authoritarians all over the place. It's all the same large-scale problem, just in our case, instead of attacking an entire country or an entire government, it's attacking just one family. The swattings that we've had to deal with have become a common tactic now against politicians, against judges, against activists. It's all utilizing the same playbook, and that has to change.
Today's episode featured Patrick S. Tomlinson. If you'd like to reach out to him, you can email at patricktomlinson@gmail.com. Or you can find him on Twitter at @stealthygeek, on Threads at @PSTomlinson, and on Blue Sky at stealthygeek.bsky.social. And to find out more information about Patrick and his books, visit patricktomlinson.com. From Wondery, you're listening to This Is Actually Happening. If you love what we do, please rate and review the show. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or on the Wondery app to listen ad-free and get access to the entire back catalog. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. By supporting them, you help us bring you our show for free. I'm your host, Whit Misseldine. Today's episode was co-produced by me and Sarah Marinelli, with special thanks to the This Is Actually Happening team, including Ellen Westberg. The intro music features the song Illibi by Tipper. You can join the community on the This Is Actually Happening discussion group on Facebook or follow us on Instagram at @actuallyhappening. On the show's website, thisisactuallyhappening.com, you can find out more about the podcast, contact us with any questions, submit your own story, or visit the store, where you can find This Is Actually Happening designs on stickers, t-shirts, wall art, hoodies, and more. That's thisisactuallyhappening.com. And finally, if you'd like to become an ongoing supporter of what we do, go to patreon.com/happening. Even $2 to $5 a month goes a long way to support our vision. Thank you for listening.
If you like This Is Actually Happening, you can listen to every episode ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Richard Bandler revolutionized the world of self-help all thanks to an approach he developed called neuro-linguistic programming. Even though NLP worked for some, its methods have been criticized for being dangerous in the wrong hands. Throw in Richard's dark past as a cocaine addict and murder suspect, and you can't help but wonder what his true intentions were. I'm Saatchi Cole.
And I'm Sarah Hagee, and we're the hosts of Scamfluencers, a weekly podcast from Wondery that takes you along the twists and turns of the most infamous scams of all time, the impact on victims, and what's left once the facade falls away.
We recently dove into the story of the godfather of modern mental manipulation, Richard Bandler, whose methods inspired some of the most toxic and criminal self-help movements of the last two decades.
Follow Scamfluencers on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Scamfluencers and more Exhibit C true crime shows like Morbid and Kill List early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. Check out Exhibit C in the Wondery app for all your true crime listening.